This is Audible.
Macmillan Audio presents Sarah's Key by Tatiana de Ronay. Read for you by Polly Stone. Paris, July 1942. The girl was the first to hear the loud pounding on the door. Her room was closest to the entrance of the apartment. At first, dazed with sleep, she thought it was her father, coming up from his hiding place in the cellar. He'd forgotten his keys, and was impatient because nobody had heard his first timid knock. But then came the voices, strong and brutal in the silence of the night. Nothing to do with her father.
Police! Open up! Now!
The pounding took up again, louder. It echoed to the marrow of her bones. Her younger brother, asleep in the next bed, stirred.
Police! Open up! Open up!
What time was it? She peered through the curtains. It was still dark outside. She was afraid. She remembered the recent, hushed conversations she had overheard, late at night, when her parents thought she was asleep. She had crept up to the living room door, and she had listened and watched from a little crack through the panel. Her father's nervous voice, her mother's anxious face. They spoke their native tongue, which the girl understood, although she was not as fluent as them. Her father had whispered that times ahead would be difficult, that they would have to be brave and very careful. He pronounced strange, unknown words. Camps. Roundup, a big roundup, early morning arrests. And the girl wondered what all of it meant. Her father had murmured that only the men were in danger, not the women, not the children, and that he would hide in the cellar every night. He had explained to the girl in the morning that it would be safer if he slept downstairs for a little while, till things got safe. What things exactly, thought the girl. What was safe? When would things be safe again? She wanted to find out what he had meant by camp and roundup, but she worried about admitting she had eavesdropped on her parents several times, so she had not dared ask him.
Open up! Police!
Had the police found Papa in the cellar? She asked herself. Was that why they were here? Had the police come to take Papa to the places he had mentioned during those hushed midnight talks? The camps far away, out of the city? The girl padded fast on silent feet to her mother's room, down the corridor. Her mother awoke the minute she felt a hand on her shoulder.
It's the police, Maman, the girl whispered. They're banging on the door.
Her mother swept her legs from under the sheets, brushed her hair out of her eyes. The girl thought she looked tired, old, much older than her 30 years.
Have they come to take Papa away?
Pleaded the girl, her hands on her mother's arms.
Have they come for him?
The mother did not answer. Again the loud voices down the hallway. The mother swiftly put a dressing gown over her nightdress, then took the girl by the hand and went to the door. Her hand was hot and clammy. Like a child's, the girl thought.
Yes?
The mother said timidly, without opening the latch. A man's voice. He shouted her name.
Yes, monsieur, that is me,
she answered. Her accent came out strong, almost harsh.
Open up! Immediately! Police!
The mother put a hand to her throat, and the girl noticed how pale she was. She seemed drained, frozen, as if she could no longer move. The girl had never seen such fear on her mother's face. She felt her mouth go dry with anguish. The men banged again. The mother opened the door with clumsy, trembling fingers. The girl winced, expecting to see green-gray suits. Two men stood there. One was a policeman, wearing his dark blue knee-length cape and a high, round cap. The other man wore a beige raincoat. He had a list in his hand. Once again, he said the woman's name, and the father's name. He spoke perfect French. "Then we are safe," thought the girl. "If they are French and not German, we are not in danger. If they are French, they will not harm us." The mother pulled her daughter close to her. The girl could feel the woman's heart beating through her dressing gown. She wanted to push her mother away. She wanted her mother to stand up straight and look at the men boldly, to stop cowering, to prevent her heart from beating like that, like a frightened animal's. She wanted her mother to be brave.
My husband is not here, stuttered the mother. I don't know where he is. I don't know.
The man with the beige raincoat shoved his way into the apartment.
Hurry up, madame. You have 10 minutes. Pack some clothes. Enough for a couple of days.
The mother did not move. She stared at the policeman. He was standing on the landing, his back to the door. He seemed indifferent, bored. She put a hand on his navy sleeve.
Monsieur, please,
she began. The policeman turned, brushing her hand away, a hard, blank expression in his eyes.
You heard me. You're coming with us. Your daughter, too. Just do as you are told.
Paris, May 2002.
Bertrand was late, as usual. I tried not to mind, but I did. Zoe lolled back against the wall, bored. She looked so much like her father, it sometimes made me smile. But not today. I glanced up at the ancient, tall building. Mamet's place. Bertrand's grandmother's old apartment. And we were going to live there. We were going to leave the Boulevard de Montparnasse, its noisy traffic, incessant ambulances due to 3 neighboring hospitals, its cafes and restaurants, for this quiet, narrow street on the right bank of the Seine. The Marais was not an arrondissement I was familiar with, although I did admire its ancient, crumbling beauty. Was I happy about the move? I wasn't sure. Bertrand hadn't really asked my advice. We hadn't discussed it much at all, in fact. With his usual gusto, he had gone ahead with the whole affair. Without me.
There he is, said Zoe. Only half an hour late.
We watched Bertrand saunter up the street with his particular sensual strut. Slim, dark, oozing sex appeal, the archetypal Frenchman. He was on the phone, as usual. Trailing behind him was his business associate, the bearded and pink-faced Antoine. Their offices were on the Rue de l'Arcade, just behind the Madeleine. Bertrand had been part of an architectural firm for a long time, since before our marriage, but he had started out on his own, with Antoine, 5 years ago. Bertrand waved to us, then pointed to the phone, lowering his eyebrows and scowling.
Like he can't get that person off the phone, scoffed Zoe. Sure.
Zoe was only 11, but it sometimes felt like she was already a teenager. First, her height, which dwarfed all her girlfriends, as well as her feet, she would add grimly, and then a precocious lucidity that often made me catch my breath. There was something adult about her solemn, hazel gaze, the reflective way she lifted her chin. She had always been like that, even as a little child. Calm, mature, sometimes too mature for her age. Antoine came to greet us while Bertrand went on with his conversation, just about loud enough for the entire street to hear, waving his hands in the air, making more faces, turning around from time to time to make sure we were hanging on to every word.
A problem with another architect, explained Antoine with a discreet smile.
A rival? Asked Zoe.
Yes, arrival, replied Antoine. Zoe sighed.
Which means we could be here all day, she said.
I had an idea.
Antoine, do you by any chance have the key to Madame Tézac's apartment?
I do have it, Julia, he said, beaming.
Antoine always spoke English to my French. I suppose he did it to be friendly, but it secretly annoyed me. I felt like my French still wasn't any good after living here all these years. Antoine flourished the key. We decided to go up, the three of us. Zoe punched out the digicode at the door with deft fingers. We walked through the leafy, cool courtyard to the elevator.
I hate that elevator, said Zoe. Papa should do something about it.
Honey, he's only redoing your great-grandmother's place, I pointed out. Not the whole building.
Well, he should, she said.
As we waited for the elevator, my mobile phone chirped out the Darth Vader theme. I peered at the number flashing on my screen. It was Joshua, my boss. I answered,
Yep.
Joshua was to the point, as usual.
Need you back by 3. Closing July issues. Over and out.
Gee whiz, I said pertly. I heard a chuckle on the other end of the line before he hung up. Joshua always seemed to like it when I said gee whiz. Maybe it reminded him of his youth. Antoine seemed amused by my old-fashioned Americanisms. I imagined him hoarding them up, then trying them out with his French accent. The elevator was one of those inimitable Parisian contraptions with a diminutive cabin, hand-maneuvered iron screen, and double wooden doors that inevitably swung in your face. Squashed between Zoe and Antoine, a trifle heavy-handed with his vetiver scent, I caught a glimpse of my face in the mirror as we glided up. I looked as eroded as the groaning lift. What had happened to the fresh-faced Belle from Boston, Mass? The woman who stared back at me was at that dreaded age between 45 and 50, that no-man's land of sag, oncoming wrinkle, and stealthy approach of menopause. I hate this elevator, too, I said grimly. Zoe grinned and pinched my cheek.
Mom, even Gwyneth Paltrow would look like hell in that mirror.
I had to smile. That was such a Zoe-like remark. The mother began to sob, gently at first, then louder. The girl looked at her, stunned. In all her 10 years, she had never seen her mother cry. Appalled, she watched the tears trickle down her mother's white, crumpled face. She wanted to tell her mother to stop crying. She could not bear the shame of seeing her mother snivel in front of these strange men. But the men paid no attention to the mother's tears. They told her to hurry up. There was no time to waste. In the bedroom, the little boy slept on.
But where are you taking us?
Pleaded her mother.
My daughter is French. She was born in Paris. Why do you want her too? Where are you taking us?
The men spoke no more. They loomed over her, menacing, huge. The mother's eyes were white with fear. She went to her room, sank down on the bed. After a few seconds, she straightened her back and turned to the girl. Her voice was a hiss, her face a tight mask.
Wake your brother. Get dressed, both of you. Take some clothes for him and you. Hurry, hurry now.
Her brother went speechless with terror when he peeped through the door and saw the men. He watched his mother, disheveled, sobbing, trying to pack. He mustered all the strength he had in his 4-year-old body. He refused to move. The girl cajoled him. He would not listen. He stood motionless, his little arms folded over his chest. The girl took off her nightdress, grabbed a cotton blouse, a skirt. She slipped her feet into shoes. Her brother watched her. They could hear their mother crying from her room.
I'm going to our secret place, he whispered.
No, she urged. You're coming with us, you must.
She grabbed him,
but he wriggled out of her grasp and slithered into the long, deep cupboard hidden in the surface of the wall of their bedroom, the one they played hide-and-seek in. They hid there all the time, locked themselves in, and it was like their own little house. Maman and Papa knew about it, but they always pretended they didn't. They'd call out their names. They'd say with loud, bright voices, "But where did those children go? How strange, they were here a minute ago," and she and her brother would giggle away with glee. They had a flashlight in there, and some cushions, and toys, and books, even a flask of water that Maman would fill up every day. Her brother couldn't read yet, so the girl would read Un bon petit diable out loud to him. He loved the tale of the orphan Charles and the terrifying Madame MacMiche, and how Charles got back at her for all her cruelty. She would read it to him over and over again. The girl could see her brother's small face peeking out at her from the darkness. He had his favorite teddy bear clutched to him. He was not frightened anymore. Maybe he'd be safe there after all. He had water and the flashlight. And he could look at the pictures in the Comtesse de Ségur book. His favorite was the one of Charles' magnificent revenge. Maybe she should leave him there for the moment. The men would never find him. She would come back to get him later in the day when they were allowed to go home again. And Papa, still in the cellar, would know where the boy was hiding if ever he came up.
"Are you afraid in there?"
she said softly, as the men called out for them.
"No,"
he said.
"I'm not afraid. You lock me in. They won't get me."
She closed the door on the little white face, turned the key in the lock. Then she slipped the key into her pocket. The lock was hidden by a pivoting device shaped like a light switch. It was impossible to see the outline of the cupboard in the paneling of the wall. Yes, he'd be safe there. She was sure of it. The girl murmured his name and laid her palm flat on the wooden panel.
"I'll come back for you later. I promise."
We entered the apartment, fumbled with light switches. Nothing happened. Antoine opened a couple of shutters. The sun poured in. The rooms were bare, dusty. Without furniture, the living room seemed immense. The golden rays slanted in through the long, grimy window panes, dappling the deep brown floorboards. I looked around at the empty shelves, the darker squares on the walls where the beautiful paintings used to hang, the marble chimney where I remembered so many winter fires burning, and Mamay holding out her delicate, pale hands to the warmth of the flames. I went to stand by one of the windows and looked down at the quiet, green courtyard. I was glad Mamay left before she ever got to see her empty apartment. It would have upset her. It upset me.
"Still smells of Mamay," said Zoe. "Shalimar."
"And of that awful Minette," I said, turning up my nose. Minette had been Mamay's last pet, an incontinent Siamese. Antoine glanced at me, surprised. "The cat," I explained. I said it in English this time. Of course I knew that la chatte was the feminine for cat, but it could also mean pussy. The last thing I wanted was having Antoine guffaw at some dubious double entendre. Antoine appraised the place with a professional eye.
"The electrical system is ancient," he remarked, pointing at the old-fashioned white porcelain fuses, "and the heating as well."
The oversized radiators were black with dirt, as scaly as a reptile.
"Wait till you see the kitchen and the bathrooms," I said. "The bathtub has claws," said Zoe. "I'm going to miss those."
Antoine examined the walls, knocking on them.
"I suppose you and Bertrand want to redo it completely?"
he asked, looking at me. I shrugged.
"I don't know what he wants to do exactly. It was his idea taking on this place. I wasn't so hot about coming here. I wanted something more practical, something new."
Antoine grinned.
"But it will be brand new once we finish it."
Maybe, but to me it will always be Mamet's apartment. The apartment still bore Mamet's imprint, even if she had moved to a nursing home 9 months ago. My husband's grandmother had lived here for years. I remembered our first encounter, 16 years back. I had been impressed by the old master paintings, the marble fireplace boasting family photos framed in ornate silver, the deceptively simple, elegant furniture, the numerous books lining the library shelves, the grand piano draped with lush red velvet. The sunny living room gave onto a peaceful inner courtyard with a thick thatch of ivy spreading out on the opposite wall. It was right here that I had met her for the first time, that I had held out my hand to her awkwardly, not yet at ease with what my sister Charla dubbed that kissy French thing. You didn't shake a Parisian woman's hand, even if you were meeting her for the first time. You kissed her once on each cheek. But I hadn't known that yet. The man with the beige raincoat looked at his list again.
"Wait," he said. "There's a child missing. A boy."
He pronounced the boy's name. The girl's heart skipped a beat. The mother glanced toward her daughter. The girl put a swift finger to her lips, a movement the men did not catch.
"Where is the boy?"
demanded the man. The girl stepped forward, wringing her hands.
"My brother is not here, monsieur," she said with her perfect French, the French of a native. "He left at the beginning of the month with some friends, to the country."
The man in the raincoat looked at her thoughtfully. Then he made a quick gesture with his chin to the policeman.
"Search the place, fast. Maybe the father is hiding too."
The policeman lumbered through the rooms, clumsily opening doors, looking under beds, into cupboards. While he made his noisy way through the apartment, the other man paced the room. When he had his back to them, the girl quickly showed her mother the key. "Papa will come up and get him. Papa will come later," she mouthed. Her mother nodded. "All right," she seemed to say. "I understand where the boy is." But her mother started to frown, to make a key gesture with her hand as if to ask, "Where will you leave the key for Papa? How will he know where it is?" The man turned around swiftly and watched them. The mother froze. The girl trembled with fear. He stared at them for a while. Then he abruptly closed the window.
"Please," the mother said. "It's so hot in here."
The man smiled. The girl thought she had never seen an uglier smile.
"We keep it closed, madame," he said. "Earlier this morning, a lady threw her child out of the window, then jumped. We wouldn't want that to happen again."
The mother said nothing, numb with horror. The girl glared at the man, hating him, hating every inch of him. She loathed his florid face, his glistening mouth, the cold, dead look in his eyes. The way he stood there, his legs spread, his felt hat tilted forward, his fat hands locked behind his back. She hated him with all her might, like she had never hated anyone in her life, more than she hated that awful boy at school, Daniel, who had whispered horrible things to her under his breath, horrible things about her mother's accent, her father's accent. She listened to the policeman continuing his clumsy search. He would not find the boy. The cupboard was too cleverly hidden. The boy would be safe. They would never find him. Never. The policeman came back. He shrugged, shook his head.
"There is no one here," he said.
The man in the raincoat pushed the mother toward the door. He asked for the keys to the apartment. She handed them over, silently. They filed down the stairs, their progress slowed by the bags and bundles the mother carried. The girl was thinking fast. How could she get the key to her father? Where could she leave it? With the concierge? Would she be awake at this hour?
Strangely, the concierge was already awake and waiting behind her door. The girl noticed she had an odd, gloating expression on her face. Why did she look like that? The girl wondered. Why did she not glance at her mother or at her, but only at the men, as if she did not want to see her or her mother, as if she had never seen them? And yet her mother had always been kind to this woman. She had looked after the concierge's baby from time to time, little Suzanne, who often fretted because of stomach pains, and her mother had been so patient, had sung to Suzanne in her native tongue, endlessly, and the baby had loved it, had fallen asleep peacefully.
"Do you know where the father and the son are?" asked the policeman.
He gave her the keys to the apartment. The concierge shrugged. She still did not look at the girl, at her mother. She pocketed the keys with a swift, hungry movement the girl didn't like.
"No," she said to the policeman. "I haven't seen much of the husband lately. Maybe he's gone into hiding with the boy. You could look through the cellars or the service rooms on the top floor. I can show you."
The baby in the small loge began to whimper. The concierge looked back over her shoulder.
"We don't have time," said the man wearing the raincoat. "We need to move on. We'll come back later if we have to."
The concierge went to get the wailing baby and held it to her chest. She said she knew there were other families in the building next door. She pronounced their names with an expression of distaste, thought the girl, as if she was saying a swear word, one of those dirty words you were never supposed to utter. Bertrand pocketed his phone at last and turned his attention to me. He gave me one of his irresistible grins. Why did I have such an impossibly attractive husband, I wondered for the umpteenth time. When I first met him all those years ago, skiing at Courchevel in the French Alps, he had been the slim, boyish type. Now, at 47, heavier, stronger, he exuded manliness, Frenchiness, and class. He was like good wine, maturing with grace and power, whereas I felt certain I had lost my youth somewhere between the Charles River and the Seine, and was certainly not blossoming in middle age. If silver hair and wrinkles seemed to highlight Bertrand's beauty, I felt sure they diminished mine.
"Well,"
he said, cupping my ass with a careless, possessive hand, despite his associate and our daughter looking on,
"well, isn't this great?"
"Great," echoed Zoe. "Antoine has just told us everything needs to be redone, which means we probably won't move in for another year."
Bertrand laughed, an amazingly infectious laugh, a cross between a hyena and a saxophone. That was the problem with my husband, intoxicating charm, and he loved turning it on full blast. I wondered whom he had inherited it from. His parents, Colette and Edouard? Wildly intelligent, refined, knowledgeable, but not charming. His sisters, Cécile and Laure? Well-bred, brilliant, perfect manners, but they only laughed when they felt they were obliged to. I guessed he probably got it from Mamet. Rebellious, belligerent Mamet.
"Antoine is such a pessimist," laughed Bertrand. "We'll be here soon enough. It will be a lot of work, but we'll get the best teams on it."
We followed him down the long corridor with creaking floorboards, visiting the bedrooms that gave onto the street.
"This wall needs to go,"
Bertrand declared, pointing, and Antoine nodded.
"We need to bring the kitchen closer. Otherwise, Miss Jarmont here wouldn't find it practical."
He said the word in English, looking at me with a naughty wink and drawing little quotation marks with his fingers in the air.
"It's quite a big apartment," remarked Antoine. "Rather grand." "Now, yes, but it was a lot smaller in the old days, a lot humbler," said Bertrand. "Times were hard for my grandparents. My grandfather didn't make good money till the 60s. Then he bought the apartment across the hall and joined the two together."
"So when Grandpère was a kid, he lived in this small part?"
Zoe asked.
"That's right,"
said Bertrand.
"This part through here, this was his parents' room, and he slept here. It was a lot smaller."
Antoine tapped on the walls thoughtfully.
Yes, I know what you're thinking,
Bertrand smiled.
You want to bring these two rooms together, right?
Right,
admitted Antoine.
Not a bad idea. He's working on, though. There's a tricky bit of wall here I'll show you later. Thick paneling, pipes and stuff going through, and not as easy as it looks.
I looked at my watch. 2:30. I have to go, I said. Meeting with Joshua.
What do we do with Zoe?
Asked Bertrand.
Zoe rolled her eyes.
I can, like, take a bus back to Montparnasse.
What about school? Said Bertrand.
Roll of eyes again.
Papa, it's Wednesday. No school on Wednesday afternoons, remember?
Bertrand scratched his head.
In my days, it...
It was on Thursday. No school on Thursdays, chanted Zoe.
A ridiculous French educational system, I sighed.
And school on Saturday mornings to boot.
Antoine agreed with me. His sons attended a private school where there were no classes on Saturday mornings, but Bertrand, like his parents, was a staunch believer in the French public school system. I had wanted to put Zoe in a bilingual school. There were several of them in Paris, but the Tézac tribe would have none of that. Zoe was French, born in France. She would go to a French school. At present, she attended the Lycée Montaigne, near the Luxembourg Garden. The Tézac kept forgetting Zoe had an American mother. Luckily, Zoe's English was perfect. I had never spoken anything else to her, and she went often enough to Boston to visit my parents. She spent most summers on Long Island with my sister Charla and her family. Bertrand turned to me. He had that little glint in his eye, the one I felt wary about, the one that meant he was going to be either very funny or very cruel, or both. Antoine obviously knew what it suggested as well, judging from the meek way he plunged into a studious survey of his patent leather tasseled loafers.
Oh, yes, indeed. We know what Miss Jarmont thinks of our schools, our hospitals, our endless strikes, our long vacations, our plumbing systems, our postal service, our TV, our politics, our dog shit on the sidewalks, said Bertrand, flashing his perfect teeth at me. We have heard about it so many times, have we not? I like to be in America. Everything's clean in America. Everybody picks up dog shit in America.
Papa, stop it. You're so rude,
Zoe said, taking my hand. Outside, the girl saw a neighbor wearing pajamas leaning from his window. He was a nice man, a music teacher. He played the violin, and she liked listening to him. He often played for her and her brother from across the courtyard. Old French songs like Sur le Pont d'Avignon and À Clairefontaine, and also songs from her parents' country, songs that always got her mother and father dancing gaily, her mother's slippers sliding across the floorboards, her father twirling her mother round and round till they all felt dizzy.
What are you doing? Where are you taking them?
He called out. His voice rang across the courtyard, covering the baby's yells. The man in the raincoat did not answer him.
But you can't do this, said the neighbor. They're honest, good people. You can't do this.
At the sound of his voice, shutters began to open. Faces peered out from behind curtains. But the girl noticed that nobody moved. Nobody said anything. They simply watched. The mother stopped dead in her tracks, her back racked with sobs. The men shoved her on. The neighbors watched silently. Even the music teacher remained silent. Suddenly the mother turned and screamed at the top of her lungs. She screamed her husband's name 3 times. The men seized her by the arms, shook her roughly. She dropped her bags and bundles. The girl tried to stop them, but they pushed her aside. A man appeared in the doorway, a thin man with crumpled clothes, an unshaven chin, and red, tired eyes. He walked through the courtyard, holding himself straight. When he came up to the men, he told them who he was. His accent was thick, like the woman's.
"Take me with my family," he said.
The girl slipped her hand through her father's. She was safe, she thought. She was safe with her mother, with her father. This was not going to last long. This was the French police, not the Germans. No one was going to harm them. Soon they'd be back in the apartment, and Maman would make breakfast, and the little boy would come out of the hiding place, and Papa would go to the warehouse down the road where he worked as a foreman and made belts and bags and wallets with all his fellow workers, and everything would be the same, and things would become safe again soon. Outside, it was daylight. The narrow street was empty. The girl looked back at her building, at the silent faces in the windows, at the concierge cuddling little Suzanne. The music teacher raised his hand slowly in a gesture of farewell. She waved back at him, smiling. Everything was going to be all right. She was coming back. They were all coming back. But the man seemed stricken. There were tears running down his face, silent tears of helplessness and shame that she could not understand.
"Rude? Your mother adores it," chuckled Bertrand, winking at Antoine. "Don't you, my love? Don't you, chérie?"
He gyrated through the living room, clicking his fingers to the West Side Story tune. I felt silly, foolish in front of Antoine. Why did Bertrand take such pleasure in making me out to be the snide, prejudiced American, ever critical of the French? And why did I just stand there and let him get away with it? It had been funny at one point. In the beginning of our marriage, it had been a classic joke, the kind that made both our American and French friends roar with laughter. In the beginning. I smiled, as usual. But my smile seemed a little tight today. "Have you been to see Mamet lately?" I asked. Bertrand was already busy measuring something.
"What?"
"Mamet," I repeated patiently. "I think she would like to see you, to talk about the apartment." His eyes met mine.
"Don't have time, amour. You go?"
A pleading look. "Bertrand, I go every week, you know that." He sighed. "She's your grandmother," I said.
"And she loves you, l'Américaine," he grinned. "And so do I, bébé."
He came over to kiss me softly on the lips. The American.
"So you're the American,"
Mamet had stated all those years ago in this very room, looking me over with brooding gray irises. "L'Américaine." How American that had made me feel, with my layered locks, sneakers, and wholesome smile. And how quintessentially French this 70-year-old woman was, with her straight back, patrician nose, impeccable coil of hair, and shrewd eyes. And yet, I liked Mamet from the start. Her startling, guttural laugh, her dry sense of humor. Even today, I had to admit I liked her more than Bertrand's parents, who still made me feel like the American, although I had been living in Paris for 25 years, been married to their son for 15, and produced their first grandchild, Zoe. On the way down, confronted once again with the unpleasant reflection in the elevator mirror, it suddenly occurred to me that I had put up with Bertrand's jabs for too long, and always with a good-natured shrug. And today, for some obscure reason, for the first time, I felt I had had enough. The girl kept close to her parents. They walked all the way down her street, the man in the beige raincoat telling them to hurry up. Where were they going? She wondered. Why did they have to rush so? They were told to go into a large garage. She recognized the road, which was not far from where she lived, from where her father worked. In the garage, men were bent over engines, wearing blue overalls stained with oil. The men stared at them, silent. No one said anything. Then the girl saw a large group of people standing in the garage, with bags and baskets at their feet. Mostly women and children, she noticed. Some of them she knew, a little. But no one dared wave or say hello to each other. After a while, two policemen appeared. They called out names. The girl's father put up his hand when their family name was heard. The girl looked around her. She saw a boy she knew from school, Leon. He looked tired and scared. She smiled at him. She wanted to tell him that everything was fine, that they could all go home soon. This wouldn't last long. They would soon be sent back. But Leon stared at her like she was crazy. She glanced down at her feet, her cheeks crimson. Maybe she had got it all wrong. Her heart was pounding. Maybe things were not going to happen like she thought they would. She felt very naive, silly, and young. Her father bent down to her. His unshaven chin tickled her ear. He said her name. Where was her brother? She showed him the key. The little brother was safe in their secret cupboard, she whispered, proud of herself. He'd be safe there. Her father's eyes went wide and strange. He grasped her arm. But it's all right, she said. He's going to be all right. It's a deep cupboard. There is enough air in there for him to breathe. And he has water and the flashlight. He'll be fine, Papa. You don't understand, said the father. You don't understand. And to her dismay, she saw that tears filled his eyes. She pulled his sleeve. She couldn't bear to see her father cry.
Papa, she said, we are going back home, aren't we? We are going back after they've called out our names?
Her father wiped his tears. He looked down at her. Awful, sad eyes she could not bear gazing back at.
No, he said. We are not going back. They won't let us go back.
She felt something cold and horrible seep through her. Once again she remembered what she had overheard, her parents' faces glimpsed from behind the door, their fear, their anguish in the middle of the night.
What do you mean, Papa? Where are we going? Why aren't we going back home? You tell me! Tell me!
She nearly screamed the last words. Her father looked down at her. He said her name again, very softly. His eyes were still wet, his eyelashes spiked with tears. He put his hand on the back of her neck.
Be brave, my sweet love. Be brave as you can.
She could not cry. Her fear was so great it seemed to engulf everything else. It seemed to suck up every single emotion within her, like a monstrous, powerful vacuum.
But I promised him I'd come back, Papa. I promised him.
The girl saw that he had started to cry again, that he wasn't listening to her. He was wrapped up in his own grief, in his own fear. They were all sent outside. The streets were empty, save for buses lined up by the sidewalks. The kind of ordinary buses the girl used to take with her mother and her brother to get about town. Ordinary, everyday, green and white buses with platforms at the rear. They were ordered to get on the buses and were pushed against each other. The girl looked again for green-gray uniforms, for the curt, guttural language she had grown to fear. But these were only policemen, French policemen. Through the bus's dusty pane, she recognized one of them, the young, red-haired one who had often helped her cross the street on her way home from school. She tapped on the glass to attract his attention. When his eyes locked onto hers, he quickly looked away. He seemed embarrassed, almost annoyed. She wondered why. As they were all pushed into the buses, a man protested and was shoved violently by police. A policeman yelled that he'd shoot if anybody tried to get away. Listlessly, the girl watched the buildings, the trees, drift by. She could only think of her brother in the cupboard, in the empty house, waiting for her. She could only think of him. They crossed a bridge. She saw the Seine sparkle. Where were they going? Papa didn't know. Nobody knew. They were all afraid. A loud clap of thunder startled everybody. The rain came pouring down so thickly the bus had to halt. The girl listened to the drops pounding on the bus's roof. It did not last long. Soon the bus resumed its route, wheels hissing on glistening cobblestones. The sun came out. The bus stopped and they all got off, laden with bundles, suitcases, crying children. The girl did not know this street. She had never been here. She saw the elevated metro on one end of the road. They were led to a great, pale building. There was something written on it in huge, dark letters, but she couldn't make it out. She saw that the entire street was full of families like hers, stepping out of buses, shouted at by the police. The French police, again. Clutching her father's hand, she was pushed and shoved into an enormous covered arena. Crowds of people were massed there in the middle of the arena, as well as on the hard, iron seats in the galleries. How many people? She didn't know. Hundreds. And there were more pouring in. The girl looked up at the immense blue skylight, shaped like a dome. The merciless sun shone through. Her father found a place for them to sit. The girl watched the steady trickle of people thicken the crowd. The noise grew louder and louder, a constant hum of thousands of voices, children whimpering, women moaning. The heat grew unbearable, more and more stifling as the sun rose higher in the sky. There was less and less room. They were all huddled against each other. She watched the men, the women, the children, their pinched faces, their frightened eyes.
"Papa," she said, "how long are we going to stay here?"
"I don't know, my sweet."
"Why are we here?"
She put her hand on the yellow star sewn on the front of her blouse.
"It's because of this, isn't it?"
she said.
"Everybody here has one."
Her father smiled a sad, pathetic smile.
"Yes," he said. "It's because of that."
The girl frowned.
"It's not fair, Papa," she hissed. "It's not fair."
He hugged her, said her name tenderly.
"Yes, my darling one, you're right. It's not fair."
She sat against him, her cheek pressed against the star he wore on his jacket. A month or so ago, her mother had sewn the stars on all her clothes. On all the family's clothes, except the little brother's. Before that, their identity cards had been stamped with the words Jew or Jewess. And then, there had been all the things they were suddenly no longer allowed to do, like playing in the park, like riding a bicycle, going to the cinema, the theater, the restaurant, the swimming pool, like no longer being allowed to borrow books from the library. She had seen the signs that seemed to be put up everywhere. Jews forbidden. And on the door of the warehouse where her father worked, a big card read, Jewish firm. Maman had to shop after 4 o'clock in the afternoon, when there was nothing left in the shops because of the rationings. They had to ride in the last carriage of the métro, and they had to be home before curfew and not leave their house till morning. What were they still allowed to do? Nothing. Nothing, she thought. Unfair. So unfair. Why? Why them? Why all this? It suddenly seemed that nobody could possibly explain it to her. Joshua was already in the meeting room, drinking the weak coffee he was fond of. I hurried in and sat between Bamber, the photo director, and Alessandra, the features editor. The room looked out onto the busy Rue Marbeuf, just a stone's throw away from the Champs-Élysées. It wasn't my favorite area of Paris, too crowded, too gaudy, but I was used to coming here every day and making my way down the avenue,
Along the large, dusty sidewalks, packed with tourists at every hour of the day, no matter what the season was. I had been writing for the weekly American magazine Sen Scenes for the past 6 years. We published a paper edition as well as an online version. I usually chronicled any event capable of interesting an American, Paris-based audience. This included local color, which ranged from social and cultural life, shows, movies, restaurants, books, to the upcoming French presidential elections. It was actually hard work. The deadlines were tight. Joshua was a tyrant. I liked him, but he was a tyrant. He was the kind of boss that had little respect for private lives, marriages, and children. If somebody got pregnant, she became a non-entity. If somebody had a sick child, she was glared at. But he had a shrewd eye, excellent editorial skills, and an uncanny gift for perfect timing. We all bowed down to him. We complained about him every time his back was turned, but we wallowed no end. 50-ish, a born and bred New Yorker who'd spent the past 10 years in Paris, Joshua looked deceptively placid. He had a longish face and drooping eyes, but the minute he opened his mouth, he ruled. One listened to Joshua, and one never interrupted him. Bamber was from London, nearly 30. He soared over 6 feet, wore purple-tinted glasses, sported various body piercings, and dyed his hair marmalade. He had a marvelous British sense of humor that I found irresistible, but that Joshua rarely understood. I had a soft spot for Bamber. He was a discreet, efficient colleague. He was also wonderful support when Joshua was going through a bad day and unleashing his temper on each of us. Bamber was a precious ally. Alessandra was part Italian, smooth-skinned, and terrifyingly ambitious. A pretty girl with a head of glossy black curls and the kind of plump, moist mouth men grow stupid about. I could never quite make up my mind whether I liked her or not. She was half my age and already getting paid as much as I was, even if my name was above hers on the masthead. Joshua went through the charts for upcoming issues. There was a hefty article coming up for the presidential elections, a big topic since Jean-Marie Le Pen's controversial victory in the first round. I wasn't too eager to write about it and was secretly glad when it was allotted to Alessandra. "Julia," said Joshua, looking up at me over his glasses. "This is up your alley. 60th commemoration of the Valdiv." I cleared my throat. What had he said? It sounded like the Valdiv. My mind went blank. Alessandra looked at me patronizingly.
"July 16, 1942. Ring a bell?" she said.
Sometimes I hated her whining, Miss Know-It-Allish voice, like today. Joshua continued.
"The great roundup at the Velodrome d'Hiver. That's what Valdiv is short for. A famous indoor stadium where biking races were held. Thousands of Jewish families locked up there for days in appalling conditions, then sent to Auschwitz and gassed."
It did ring a bell, only faintly. "Yes," I said firmly, looking at Joshua.
"Okay, what then?"
He shrugged.
"Well, you could start with finding Valdiv survivors or witnesses. Then check up on the exact commemoration, who's organizing it, where, when. Finally, facts. What happened exactly? It'll be delicate work, you know. The French aren't fond of talking about Vichy, Patin, all that. Not something they're overly proud of."
"There's a man who could help you," said Alessandra, slightly less patronizingly. "Franck Lévy. He created one of the biggest associations to help Jewish people find their families after the Holocaust."
"I've heard of him," I said, jotting down his name. I had. Franck Lévy was a public figure. He gave conferences and wrote articles about stolen Jewish goods and the horrors of deportation. Joshua gulped another coffee down.
"Nothing wishy-washy," he said. "No sentimentalism. Facts. Testimonies. And
glancing at Bamber. Good, strong photos. Look up old material as well. There isn't much available, as you will discover, but maybe this Levy guy could help you.
I'll start by going to the Veldiv, said Bamber. Check it out.
Joshua smiled wryly.
The Veldiv doesn't exist anymore. Torn down in 59.
Where was it? I asked, glad that I wasn't the only ignoramus. Alessandra answered once again.
Rue Nélatan, in the 15th arrondissement.
We could still go there, I said, looking at Bamber. Maybe there are people living on the street who remember what happened.
Joshua raised his shoulders. You could give it a try, he said. But I don't think you'll find many people willing to talk to you. As I told you, the French are touchy. This is highly sensitive subject matter. Don't forget, it's the French police who arrested all those Jewish families, not the Nazis.
Listening to Joshua, I realized how little I knew about what happened in Paris in July 1942. I hadn't learned about it in class back in Boston, and since I had come to Paris 25 years ago, I had not read much about it. It was like a secret, something buried in the past, something no one mentioned. I was itching to get in front of the computer and start searching the internet. As soon as the meeting was over, I went to my little cubbyhole of an office overlooking the noisy Rue Marbeuf. We had cramped working space, but I was used to it. It didn't bother me. I had no place to write at home. Bertrand had promised I'd have a large room to myself in the new apartment. My own private office, at last. It seemed too good to be true. The kind of luxury that would take some getting used to. I turned on the computer, logged onto the internet, then onto Google. I typed, Velodrome d'Hiver, Veldiv. The listings were numerous. Most of them were in French. A lot of them were very detailed. I read for the entire afternoon. I did nothing but read and store information and search for books about the occupation and roundups. Many of the books I noticed were out of print. I wondered why. Because nobody wanted to read about the Veldiv? Because no one cared anymore? I called a couple of bookstores. I was told it was going to be tough getting hold of the books. Please try, I said. When I turned the computer off, I felt overwhelmingly tired. My eyes ached. My head and heart were heavy with everything I'd learned. There had been over 4,000 Jewish children penned in the Veldiv, aged between 2 and 12. Most of the children were French, born in France. None of them came back from Auschwitz. The day dragged on, endless, unbearable. Huddled against her mother, the girl watched the families around her slowly losing their sanity. There was nothing to drink, nothing to eat. The heat was stifling. The air was full of a dry, feathery dust that stung her eyes and her throat. The great doors to the stadium were closed. Along each wall, sullen-faced policemen threatened them silently, hands on their guns. There was nowhere to go, nothing to do, except to sit here and wait. Wait for what? What was going to happen to them, to her family, to this mass of people? With her father, they had tried to find the restrooms at the other end of the arena. An unimaginable stench greeted them. There were too few toilets for such a crowd, and these were soon out of order. The girl had to squat against the wall to relieve herself, fighting against the overpowering urge to vomit, her hand clapped over her mouth. People were pissing and defecating wherever they could, ashamed, broken, cowering like animals near the filthy floor. She saw a dignified old woman hiding behind her husband's coat. Another woman was gasping with horror, clasping her hands over her mouth and nose, shaking her head. The girl followed her father through the crowd, back to where they'd left her mother. They had to pick their way through the throng. The galleries were thick with bundles, bags, mattresses, cribs, the arena black with people. How many, she wondered.
How many people here? Children ran through the aisles, bedraggled, dirty, screaming for water. A pregnant woman, faint with heat and thirst, yelled at the top of her lungs that she was going to die, that she was going to die now. An old man collapsed suddenly, flat out on the dusty floor, his blue face contorted and twitched. Nobody moved. The girl sat down next to her mother. The woman had gone quiet. She hardly spoke. The girl took her hand and squeezed it. Her mother did not respond. The father got up to ask a policeman for water for his child and wife. The man replied curtly that there was no water for the moment. The father said that this was abominable, that they could not be treated like dogs. The policeman turned away. The girl saw Leon again, the boy she had seen in the garage. He was wandering through the crowd, looking toward the great doors. She noticed he was not wearing his yellow star. It had been torn off. She got up, went to him. His face was grimy. There was a bruise on his left cheek, another on his collarbone. She wondered if she looked like that too, tired and battered.
"I'm getting out of here," he said in a low voice. "My parents have told me to, now."
"But how?" she said. "The police will never let you through."
The boy looked at her. He was her age, 10, but he appeared much older. There was no longer anything boyish about him.
"I'll find a way," he said. "My parents told me to go. They took off the star. It's the only way. Otherwise, it's the end for all of us."
Again, she felt the cold fear surge through her. The end? Was this boy right? Was it really the end? He gazed at her, slightly contemptuous.
"You don't believe me, do you? You should come with me. Take off your star. Come with me now. We'll hide. I'll look after you. I know what to do."
She thought of her little brother in the cupboard, waiting. She fingered the smooth key in her pocket. She could go with this fast, clever boy. She could save her brother and herself. But she felt too small, too vulnerable to do anything like that alone. She was too frightened. And her parents, her mother, her father, what would happen to them? Was this boy telling the truth? Could she trust him? He put a hand on her arm, sensing her reluctance.
"Come with me," he urged.
"I don't know," she muttered.
He backed away.
"I've made up my mind. I'm leaving. Goodbye."
She watched him edge toward the entrance. The police were letting more people in. Old men on stretchers and in wheelchairs. Endless groups of sniveling children. Tearful women. She watched Leon glide through the crowd, waiting for the right moment. At one point, a policeman grabbed him by the collar and threw him back. Lithe and quick, he picked himself up, inching back toward the doors, like a swimmer adroitly fighting the current. The girl watched, fascinated. A group of mothers stormed the entrance, angrily demanding water for the children. The police seemed momentarily confused, not knowing what to do. The girl saw the boy slip through the pandemonium easily, fast as lightning. Then he was gone. She went back to her parents. The night began to fall, slowly, and with it the girl felt that her despair, and that of the thousands of people locked in here with her, began to grow, like something monstrous, out of control, a sheer, utter despair that filled her with panic. She tried to shut her eyes, her nose, her ears, to block out the smell, the dust, the heat, the howls of anguish, the visions of adults crying, of children moaning, but she could not. She could only watch, helpless, silent. From high up near the skylight, where people were sitting in little groups, she noticed a sudden commotion, a heart-wrenching yell, a flurry of clothes cascading over the balconies, and a thump
on the hard floor of the arena. Then a gasp from the crowd.
Papa, what was that?
She asked. Her father tried to turn her face away.
Nothing, darling, nothing. Just some clothes falling from up there.
But she had seen. She knew what it was. A young woman, her mother's age, and a small child. The woman had jumped, her child held close from the highest railing. From where the girl sat, she could see the dislocated body of the woman, the bloody skull of the child, sliced open like a ripe tomato. The girl bent her head and cried.
When I was a girl, living at 49 Hislop Road in Brookline, Mass., I never imagined I'd move to France one day and marry a Frenchman. I figured I'd stay in the States all my life. At 11, I had a crush on Evan Frost, the boy next door, a freckle-faced Norman Rockwell kid with a retainer, whose dog Inky liked to romp on my father's beautiful flower beds. My dad, Sean Jarmond, taught at MIT, a mad professor type with unruly locks and owl-like glasses. He was popular. Students liked him. My mom, Heather Carter Jarmond,